It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 252-247-7282, and let's talk legal.
And we'd like to welcome into the studio Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from Harvell and Collins. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Michael.
And,
Mike.
And our topic today is going to be...
Cecil. Mike, we're going to talk about legal capacity, if you will, to execute a last will and testament, and kind of the other side of the coin to capacity, of course, is undue influence. They tend to go together, as one would think right out of the gate, you know, when someone potentially has diminished capacity in some way, maybe they are more prone to then being unduly influenced, as opposed to someone who's, you know, very strong and healthy and doing very, very well, they might not be as prone to be subject to undue influence. Mm-hmm. So in the litigation cases that we see in our office, those issues being undue influence and capacity tend to kind of go together. Wes is going to take over here in just a moment, because as we talked about out in the lobby before we walked in here, I said, Wes, why don't we talk about capacity and undue influence? And he said, well, that would be just fine, because guess what? I'm buried in it.
Wow. You have a lot of cases.
You know, yeah. There's a lot of cases that touch and concern these issues. And so let's go out of the gate here with some definitions and some background information on capacity. And our listeners are going to be intrigued, because, you know, it isn't necessarily what you think. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What you might assume, you know, this morning with your cup of coffee at your kitchen table is capacity might just not be quite what you would assume it to be. So let's listen now to the lawyers tell us what capacity is when it comes to signing a last will and testament.
Wes?
So, I just kind of live and breathe this, because I deal with so many cases, you know, defending cases or prosecuting cases on the plaintiff side of things, where since we do at Harvell and Collins so much estate work, whether it's estate administration or doing the estate planning on the front end, or dealing with issues of litigation involving challenging documents after the person has passed away, in most cases, it's oftentimes that the issues that are brought before the court and that I deal with are these issues of undue influence and mm-hmm. lack of capacity. I mean, that's kind of your typical thing you'd look at when there is, let's say, your standard caveat to a will, meaning a challenge to a will after someone's passed away.
Right.
Undue influence and lack of capacity. These things also come up, these elements come up of undue influence and lack of capacity when you're talking about things like maybe documents getting changed, like beneficiary designations on accounts, maybe taking someone who's elderly to the bank and getting them to change things, or using a power of attorney to change things, or this type of litigation, or a trust that's signed, or even potentially a deed that's signed. So these are the things that you normally see in these type of cases, undue influence and lack of capacity. And basically what they are, you know, when we're talking about capacity, let's take that first. The standard with regard to capacity is, you know, number one, do you understand at the time of the execution of the document who the natural objects of your bounty are? That's the way the law mm-hmm. indicates that. And that's basically who your family is, who your normal heirs would be. Do you understand the nature and extent of your assets? You don't have to know every penny that you have, but generally have an understanding as to what you do have. And then third, do you have the capacity to understand the effect of a will? And that a will is a document that's going to operate in order to carry out your wishes. So that overall is a relatively low standard, Mike. I mean, we just talk about those three things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not, you know, necessarily a standard of, for example, whether someone's competent. I even hear attorneys get that mixed up sometimes. Competency is something completely different than testamentary capacity to make a will. There are cases in North Carolina that indicate that you can be incompetent, meaning adjudicated incompetent mm-hmm. in a court of law, and still have the capacity to enter a will. And sometimes I get into these cases, and the lawyer on the other side keeps mm-hmm. using the word competency, 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 and that's competency to make a will. There's really no such thing. It's capacity. It's testamentary capacity, you know, to be able to enter a will. So there's a little bit of overlap, though, as Cecil and I, you know, often talk about, because, you know, the other side of that is the undue influence. This is someone's being forced into doing something or signing the will, or someone is being subjected to influence over a long period of time. Maybe, for example, there's a caregiver in the home who keeps talking about, you know, leave me this, leave me that, mm-hmm. I'll take care of you, you don't need to worry about it, leave me something, you know, or maybe even trying to divide the family members, you know, from this principle.
Create a wedge.
Create the wedge.
Yeah.
And then over time, then that may rise to the level of undue influence. Now, just the cases are pretty clear that simple persuasion in conversation is not undue influence. I mean, you can always talk with somebody and say, you know, it sure would be nice if you if you leave me that Cadillac or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. Or have you thought about me in your will? That's not undue influence. What has to be, what rises to the level of undue influence is when it's the influencer's intent that's being imposed and it shows up in the document. And that influence has to take place at the time of the execution of the will. That doesn't mean the person's holding a gun to the other person's head. That means that at the time they're signing the will, the influence that's taking place, it could be over a period of time, is affecting this person's ability to make their own decisions with regard to what they want. Now, someone being subjected to undue influence, normally, you know, if you're weak, physically weak, if you're on up in age, probably more susceptible. So see, there's an overlap there between mm-hmm. lack of capacity, because a lot of times our folks who may have lack of capacity or possibly have lack of capacity are on up in age, right? We get a little weaker and lose our capacity to a certain extent, you know, as we get older. So probably more of a target of undue influence. So that's one of the elements that we look at as well.
And you said you have so many of these cases come across your desk in your office at Harvell and Collins. As you're describing this defining this, Wes, it sounds very subjective in trying to determine both the undue influence and lack of capacity.
Great point. And let me make a comment about that for Cecil. I can tell you're sitting on go. You have
I'm very good over here.
As we sit in the studio. So it is subjective, okay? And normally these questions are jury questions, okay? And what does that mean, lawyer? What are you talking about? Yeah. Oh, everything's a jury question. No, what that means is that there are some issues that the court can decide themselves, meaning the judge. Mm-hmm. The judge can look at it and say, this doesn't get to a jury. Not everything gets to the jury. I mean, you got to have enough evidence to be able to get to the jury. Kind of generally stated, what that means is that there needs to be what's called a genuine issue of material fact. There needs to be enough evidence on whatever the particular issue is for the issue to get to the jury. So a lot of these issues of undue influence and lack of capacity, they do get to the jury, but we have some cases in North Carolina that are very much on point with regard to what the court can consider to dismiss the case if you mm-hmm. don't have the evidence. I mean, just because you bring a will caveat, a challenge to a will based on undue influence and lack of capacity, doesn't mean it automatically gets to the jury. For example, there's one case in particular where there was general testimony with regard to the overall decline of this person, the person who signed the will. How he just wasn't doing well, and at certain times he couldn't remember things. and he was better in the afternoon or better in the morning than he was in the afternoon.
Sure.
This general type of conversation, there was no evidence that this person lacked capacity and did not know the three elements, the three things, family, assets, and the effect of the will, or lacked that capacity at the time that he signed the will. The court on lack of capacity granted summary judgment on that. That went up to the Court of Appeals and I think the Supreme Court as well. And that summary judgment was upheld. Mm. There just wasn't any evidence that there was lack of capacity at the time of signing the document. Okay. So just this general idea that daddy or mommy or grandma or grandpa just wasn't doing well. They were declining, didn't recognize who I was one day. Just general conversations like that, general mm-hmm. testimony like that, based on what our Court of Appeals has said, doesn't get you there. You have to have something more specific. And I would offer one thing. I'm going to kind of just segue into what Cecil may be saying. I tell you, one of the things that you can do in order to avoid a challenge to your document, go to a good lawyer. Yeah. Don't sign it on the kitchen table, because a good attorney is going to sit down with you, go through the document, make sure you understand what it is, kind of do your analysis of the capacity like we've just talked about, have the witnesses come in, ask questions in front of the witnesses, make sure everything is done perfectly, and in the event that some family member ends up trying to challenge your document, all of those people are going to be witnesses mm-hmm. to upheld what your wishes were. And a good attorney also is going to stop the presses in the event there's a problem. Last week, Cecil mm-hmm. and I were talking about a particular situation without getting into too much detail. There was a call into our office about so-and-so wanted a will done, wanted to make some changes. And Mr. Harvell here interviewed that person on the phone, made the determination this person didn't have capacity. We're not going to do that. We're not going to touch it because the person didn't have capacity to sign the will. So,
and the telephone call came in from, one of the beneficiaries. Whose position would have improved.
Right. Exactly.
And was doing all the talking.
Yeah.
And then when I go to talk with the real person of interest here, which of course would be the testator, the person who signs the will, he or she was unable to really carry on a conversation with me. Mike, back a moment to capacity. The objects of your bounty. This doesn't mean you have to know the names and addresses of your children, grandchildren. You don't even have to know where they live. Okay. You don't have to know how old they are. You don't have to know their social security numbers.
mm-hmm.
This is not what the law and the case law in the state of North Carolina require. So, do you have children? How many children have you had? And generally the nature of your family. The same is true with regard to your property, your assets. You don't have to know necessarily, what the names of the banks are, what the values are in the accounts, what the nature of those assets are versus, say, an IRA
mm-hmm.
versus an annuity versus a mutual fund versus an after-tax stock account. I mean, I've got clients that, my age, your age, Mike, that can't tell me that.
I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
Yeah, I've got something.
Or tell me one thing, and then when we get the account statements, we see it's a little bit different.
Right.
We need our listeners to hear this because capacity to execute a last will and testament is a lower standard.
As Wes pointed out.
Yes.
Yep.
Than most folks make the assumption, to be. And the reason for this.
Let's hold your thought there.
Sure.
We'll come back.
I
want to
tell you the
reason. We'll find the reason for that. We're going to take a short break here. And if you can join the conversation now, 252-247-7282, or to Wes Collins's point, get a good attorney and go over this. A good attorney would be Harvell and Collins. You can reach them at 252-726-9050. We'll take a short break here. We'll be right back with Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. You can join the conversation now by calling 252-247-7282, or you can reach Harvell and Collins after the show by going online to harvellandcollins.com or calling here in Moorhead City, 726-9050.
Cecil, what I was going to say was that, and then I'll go back a little bit, but the rationale for this, if you will, I hate to use the word lower standard, but not necessarily this, you know, every single detail is because we want to encourage the last will and testament to be upheld, because after all, that is the last will and testament of an individual versus them dying without a will, which then the intent is dictated by state statute, as mm-hmm. we've spoken so many times here. In other words, Mike, when you don't have a will, then you die intestate, and the state of North Carolina then dictates where your assets are to go. Mm-hmm. The state of North Carolina does not want to necessarily have that responsibility. They would prefer, and the law therefore supports, that we have a last will and testament. Okay. And again, back to, you know, things like, you know, the nature and extent of your property, the objects of your bounty, your family. I don't mean to say that you don't need to know, you know, whether your children are male or female or anything. I mean, you know, you can't say I've got three girls and in fact you have three adult men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you've got to know the objects of your bounty. Who are they? You know, what are their names? You don't have to have their married names in the spelling and things of that nature. We have a difficult time at our office getting that information sometimes from clients. We have a difficult time sometimes getting all of the financial information, okay? But you need to know, you know, who the objects of your bounty are. You need to know the nature of your property, where you live, where your home happens to be. And if you think about it for a moment, Mike, and if our listeners think about it for a moment, an awful lot of people know that information.
Pretty basic.
They might not know, you know, who the president is or what the date is or necessarily even, you know, what day of the month or the date, like today is September the 15th, I think.
Mm-hmm.
All right, fine. But they know how many children they have and what their names are. And they know where their home is, okay? They know where they are, okay? This is something that, you know, it's almost a little bit, many times, kind of a little bit black and white. You either know those things
mm-hmm.
or you either don't.
Mm. Without getting too specific, too. And I know my money's at Bank of America and I have a T. Rowe Price account. And that's mm-hmm. pretty much says the capacity of my financial bounty.
Correct.
Easy right. questions. Mm-hmm. Low barrier to enter into that document. I think that's fair to say. It's fair.
Right. So a lot of times when we're looking at this lack of capacity issue, medical records obviously make a big difference. And in many cases, we deal with these cases. We don't have those medical records. I mean, for example, you know, I represent a child that's been disinherited or a child that's largely been disinherited, and the child may think that mom or dad who's passed away was subjected to undue influence, lack capacity, so on and so forth, by the other child.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that other child may very well be the executor of the estate too, as named in the will. So we're not in a position at that point in time to be able to get the medical records which we would want around the time that this document was signed. There's all kind of jewels in medical records sometimes. I mean, there's indications that the person, you know, had an advanced dementia presentation, or there was a mini mental state examination done that they did very poorly on.
Mm-hmm.
We can even sometimes find out that there was some factual situations, there's a psychological evaluation that's done, and or it could be just basic records that, you know, the person went to the emergency room but was only oriented times one, meaning they didn't know time, person, place. They just knew maybe who they were.
Yeah.
And so those records in many cases give a pretty good roadmap as to what was going on in that person's life from a mental standpoint, a cognitive standpoint, at and around the time, you know, that the subject document was signed, you know. And because, you know, you go to the doctor, you're being analyzed for whatever it may be. It could be because you had a fall and you go to the ER, or you go to your cardiologist or whatever it may be. Typically, there's going to be a review of symptoms that takes place, and some of those symptoms that we look at on your standard documentation are things like your cognitive condition, your psychological condition, these type things. So then we potentially sometimes get to the point where we're deposing the doctor who actually entered the information to make a determination as to how the person was doing at that particular time. So in many cases, we don't have that information from the outset, but then we get it through the process.
You can see where you call those jewels, because you can timeline that person's life at that point in time and see.
Yeah, a huge part of any type of capacity case.
Yeah. We'll take a short break here and return with our final segment of Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. You can reach them after the show at 726-9050 or go online to harvellandcollins.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. You can reach them after the show at 252-726-9050 or go online to harvellandcollins.com. Again, another interesting topic, gentlemen, one that affects all of us at some point in time in our life. And Wes, I'll let you close out today's segment.
You know, the D word. We see that in medical records all the time for folks who are on up in age, dementia.
Dementia.
And that's just the, I think, fancy word for you're getting older.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably... I would guess that maybe back in the 1950s or so, that word didn't show up in medical records so much. It just more as the word now.
It's probably called forgetful back then.
Yeah, forgetful. Yeah. You know, and that's, you know, the wife comes in and says, well, he doesn't remember things quite as well as he used to. And, well, then the doctor then puts in the records possible onset of mild dementia. Well, that all that really means is you're just getting a little bit older. Mm-hmm. I think most people are suffering from that when you get on up in your, you know, older years. But that in no way means that a person doesn't have capacity in her will. Now, just kind of keep this in mind, okay? Folks who have mild dementia, forgetfulness, do they normally know who their family is? Yes.
Yes.
Do they know what the assets are? Yes. And would they know what a will does? Yeah, I'll leave my stuff to my wife, to my kids.
Right.
So, you know, that is not the... That's not like the iron curtain for being able to do a will, where you can't get past it. I mean, that's just such a minor thing. And that's, I'm not just talking off the cuff. I know we just have a minute left. I've read hundreds of thousands of pages of medical records. I know what's in there.
Yep.
So, you know.
I think a lot of the takeaways from this show, get good legal advice when you're talking about wills. Call Harvell and Collins for that good legal advice. Great legal advice. 252-726-9050 or go online to HarvellandCollins.com. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.